Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the artistry of bluesman Taj Mahal, soprano Cecilia Bartoli, ballet flamenco Jose Porcel, and family entertainers Dan Zanes and Michael Cooper during the 2005-2006 season. Watch for your Krannert Center season brochure the first week of May or visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In 1940, shortly before the Blumenthal family was to emigrate from Europe to the U.S., Germany invaded Holland. The German Jewish family was in Holland waiting to sail to the U.S., but with the invasion of Holland, their plans for escape were dashed. The family, Father Walter, Mother Ruth, and children, Albert and Marion, survived 5 years in Hitler's camps. Marion Blumenthal was 10 and a half when the family was liberated in 1945. She weighed 35 pounds. Marion Blumenthal Lazan, co-author of the young adult book Four Perfect Pebbles, A Holocaust Story, is visiting Champaign-Urbana to tell her story. She's visiting schools in the area. And this evening she will speak at 7 o'clock at Champaign's First United Methodist Church at 210 West Church Street. The event is free and open to the public. Tomorrow evening, WILL-TV will broadcast the documentary Marion's Triumph, Surviving History's Nightmare. That broadcast, 8 p.m. tomorrow evening. This afternoon, Marion Blumenthal Lazan is our guest. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the area, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Marion, good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming in and joining me this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
In my introduction, I mentioned that your family was trapped in Holland in 1940 when Hitler invaded, but your family's ordeal begins much earlier, in the 1930s, when your parents decide that they're going to have to leave Germany. What can you tell us about how they made that decision, how they came to that decision?
We saw problems arising early on in the mid-30s when the Nuremberg laws were formulated and enforced. And that's when the many, many restrictions were imposed on Jewish people. For instance, Jews were not allowed into theaters, into swimming pools, into parks. All public schools were closed to Jewish children. Jews were only allowed to shop during specific hours of the day, things of that sort. And these restrictions went on and on. And it was then that my parents decided to make arrangements to leave the country. We lived with my grandparents at the time, who were in their 70s and ill, and had no intentions of leaving their home. They could not understand the necessity of leaving. And when they passed away in 1938, within 11 days of each other, my parents then made the final arrangements to leave the country. At that time, I was 4 years old.
Yeah. And the year is 1938. Now things are becoming even more dangerous, aren't they?
Tremendously. And then, of course, November 9th, 1938, Kristallnacht, or Crystal Night, That was the night of broken glass when the Nazis smashed the windows and the storefronts of Jewish-owned stores, Jewish establishments, synagogues, and Jewish books were destroyed and burned. And this was the beginning of a massive pogrom against the Jews in Germany, a massive mental and physical assault against all German Jews. And to think that just a few days later, November 12th, the German government actually fined the Jewish population for the damage caused that night. And of course, that gave them the funds to purchase and buy extra weapons and rearm themselves.
Yeah. How was your family affected November 9th, November 10th, 1938?
The night of Kristallnacht, my father was taken away from our home and, unbeknownst to my mother, was sent to concentration camp Buchenwald in Germany. And all sorts of terrible stories were related to my mother, and we did not know if we would ever see my father again. He was released after 10 days only because our immigration papers were in order. And to think that just a few years prior to that, he had been awarded the Iron Cross for his military service in the German army of World War I. But that didn't matter to Hitler and his people.
Yeah. So now it's early 1939, and the family leaves Germany for Holland.
Mm-hmm.
You're too young at this moment to remember what that was like, but you talked about it with your mom. What did she tell you about leaving Germany and heading off for knows what?
Whatever you hear me relate now, up until about the age of six or seven, was told to me by my mother. And we were forced to sell both our home and our business for a fraction of its worth in Hoya, the little town where we lived. And then we, after Kristallnacht, we left for Holland, from where we were to sail to the United States. And during that time, for 9 months, my parents were assigned to take care of some 125 children. And these young children were sent by their parents from various parts of Europe to escape from the Nazis. We, at that time, were awaiting our quota number from the American State Department. Everything was in order. We had our tickets. We had our visa. We had our affidavit, which would it's a document that vouches so that we would not be a burden to the American government. Everything was intact except for the quota number. So that's what we waited for. And then it was 1940 when the Germans invaded Holland, and we were trapped. That was it. We then were deported to the detention camp of Westerbork in Holland, where we were waiting for our departure date. Our quota number sort of was intact. And but once the Germans invaded, that was it. We knew that there was no chance to leave. And Camp Westerbork was tolerable and under the Dutch control. But once the Germans came in, things became much more difficult. Yeah. We got acquainted with the barbed wire and 12-foot-high wire that was always with us throughout those 6.5 years in the camps.
Yeah, all together. From the outset of your
We were all together in Westerbork, Bergen-Belsen, which comes later. We were separated.
Right. Well, what was life like in the refugee camp, and how was it transformed after the German invasion, once the Dutch were no longer administering it?
Initially, my brother, my father, brother, mother, and I shared two small rooms in Camp Westerbork in Holland. And eventually, though, we shared our small quarters with another family. That's was after thousands of Jews were rounded up and taken from their hiding places, as was Anne Frank and her family. And at that time, we had to share our small quarters with another family, and that was really, that wasn't even such a problem. We had enough food to eat. We all ate in a communal dining room, no problem. My father worked to repair shoes. My mother worked in the kitchen. We children had a makeshift education and really lived a very dull, stagnant life. And at that time, I was already 6 years old. And but then when the Germans took over, we got acquainted with that ever-present, terrifying 12-foot-high barbed wire. And as I said earlier, once they took over and people were taken from their hiding places, we shared our quarters, and that was still all right. It was not a problem.
Yeah.
But then the transports.
July 1942.
The transports to the concentration and extermination camps in Eastern Europe began. And yes, that started in 1942, early 1942. And from then on, almost every Tuesday morning, men, women, little ones were marched to a nearby railroad platform from where they were transported. And this area was always known as Boulevard de Misère, a French word for misery. Complete misery, that particular platform. And we had heard about the extermination camps and about gas chambers, so people just never came back once they left.
Yeah. Now, were you and your older brother aware of what was happening? Or, you know, to what extent were your parents able to shelter you?
We were fortunate that in Westerbork we were always together. So that was tremendous help. Mm-hmm. And, of course, eventually I was told that, you know, this is not, and I understood for myself that this was not a normal way of life. And but yet for me, I didn't know anything else. I only remember incarceration. And then, of course, we were told that there's another world out there. And I knew for sure I wanted that other world to be a part of my life once again. And I was always very fortunate to have been with my mother, who was is a very positive lady. And it's through her tremendous positive energy that I'm here. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I have seen her in the documentary. She's something. And her picture appears in Four Perfect Pebbles in a number of places. Mm-hmm. And let's get a little ahead of the story here. When you finally make it to the United States, your mother, your brother Albert, yourself, mm-hmm. You marry in 1953?
Correct.
And then children and grandchildren?
For sure. And as we had just mentioned, when I showed you, or you showed me the picture in my memoir, Four Perfect Pebbles, is a picture of the entire family. And that is my husband and my mother, of course, our three children who are all married and have given us 9 beautiful grandchildren. So this definitely shows continuity and survival.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll always be here. I don't guess. I know we'll always be here.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful photograph. Mm-hmm. And your mother is standing in the heart of in the center of the photograph. Mm-hmm. And the way you're arranged, it almost looks like you are a heart. This family takes the shape of a heart. But it must have been quite the moment for your mother when your first child was born. And these family get-togethers just must be
very special, very special. We're pretty much spread all over. We have children and grandchildren in Florida. We have children and grandchildren in Israel. And one set, our daughter lives near us with her family, husband and 2 children. So, but it's difficult to get the family together, but we do as often as we possibly can.
Yeah, that's terrific. And at the end of the documentary, you and your brother and mother are sitting at a table, mm-hmm. and you and Albert are talking about some of the things that your mother has lots of sayings. And I thought, I wonder what those sayings are. Maybe you'd give us an example or two of how she guided you with apparently these little gems of wisdom.
Well, I wrote them all down. And every day she seems to come up with something else. They're German expressions. And for instance, when we were talking about how Nathaniel and I met, she says, yeah, auf jeden Topf passt ein Deckel, on every pot, a cover fits on every pot. So in other words, we are a match, Nathaniel and I. And for instance, she's not a procrastinator. And her expression, morgen, morgen, nun nicht heute, sagen alle Frauen, Leute, tomorrow, tomorrow, but not today, is what the lazy people say. So yeah, but she's quite remarkable. She's quite remarkable in all respects. Very strong, takes no medication, Tylenol, that's it. And that I decided long ago is not a medication. So she's quite remarkable at 97.
97. Mm-hmm. Terrific. Marion Blumenthal Lazan is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is a survivor of the Holocaust, and she is in the Champaign-Urbana area. To tell her story, she's visiting schools in the area. This evening, she'll speak at 7 o'clock at Champaign's First United Methodist Church at 210 West Church Street. The event is free and open to the public. And tomorrow evening, our companion station WILL-TV will broadcast the documentary Marion's Triumph, Surviving History's Nightmare. That broadcast set for tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine, and you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. When did you begin telling your story? Now, this is something I know that is very important to you. You have the memoir, and someone has made the documentary. How did you, when and how and why did you decide this is something I must do?
I was initially invited to speak at our synagogue in 1979. I live in New York, and that was the first time that I actually spoke formally about my childhood experiences during the Holocaust. Prior to that, friends, relatives, even my husband, in bits and pieces, I got the information. But when I was asked to talk about it formally, I had to sit down and I had to put my thoughts on paper. And I worked on that for almost 3 days, and I was not a happy person at that time. All the many thoughts that I had suppressed for so many years had come forth. And can you imagine after 30, it took almost that long to really open up. We needed to put it aside so that we could go on with our lives. And in addition to that, we didn't think that anyone would believe us anyway. So we sort of held back. And when I did speak at our synagogue, it was for Yom HaShoah. That is the Holocaust Remembrance Day that falls in the spring of each year. Various dates. The date's not always the same because we go by the Jewish calendar. And there were teachers in the audience. And the next thing I knew, I was invited to speak in their schools. And it was Lila Pearl who heard me in 1991. This is already 20, mm-hmm. About 11, 12 years later. She heard me speak in one of the schools. She saw the reaction of the students and then asked whether I would work with her to put the story into book form. So we worked together for about a year and a half. And with the help of my mother and my brother, we were able to get the manuscript together, and it was accepted almost immediately. Mm. There are very few nonfiction stories from a child's perspective pertaining to that subject. So many of them are historical fiction, and they're wonderful, wonderful books, but they're very few from a child's perspective that are nonfiction.
Oh.
So I've been told.
How did your mother and brother feel about the project?
Very supportive, very supportive. And my mother, Lila Pearl, the co-author, tremendous writer, wonderful person. She told me after she heard me speak on her way home, she already formulated the chapters of the book. So she already knew what it was going to be like, and she had it all figured out. And we, as I said, my mother had to be involved because there's so much that I do not remember, particularly before the age of 5 and 4. So she helped fill in the voice, as did my brother. He was very supportive, even though he deals with the situation altogether differently than I do.
Yeah. Well, you have to respect him for that.
100%. He has a very difficult time speaking about it, and he has opened up a bit, as you had seen on the documentary. He talks about it, but is happily married, but by choice will not bring children into this world, has rejected organized religion, and all of this makes me sad, but I do not fault him. He was with my father in the men's section, saw and experienced things that I did not. So, but I'm glad that he opened up. It makes it a little bit easier for him.
Yeah. Tell us about the significance of the title of this memoir, Four Perfect Pebbles.
Four Perfect Pebbles. The title is based on one of the many imaginative games that I played to keep myself busy. In Camp Bergen-Belsen, we had nothing to occupy our time with, nothing constructive. And here I was already 9 years old at that time, and life was so difficult, and we were always hungry, and we were always in some sort of a pain, either mental or physical. And I thought for myself that if I were to find four pebbles of about the same size and shape, that would mean that the four members of my family would all survive, my mother, my father, my brother, and I. It was, of course, a very difficult game to play. But it gave me something to hold on to. For instance, what would happen if I couldn't find that third or fourth pebble? Might that mean that one or two of my family members would not survive? Nevertheless, this game gave me hope. This was one of the few games that I played, and they were my survival techniques. These games were my survival skills. And as I tell the audience, no one is spared adversity. No one is spared hardship. But with determination, with perseverance, with faith and hope, one can overcome just about anything and everything. And survival skills we all have within us. When the need arises, we just have to search for them, find them, and be sure that we put them to work. So we can all learn a little something from this, I hope. And it just works so well to speak to students and adults as well. They so much identify, because somewhere along the way I was their age.
Yeah. Now, your brother was a little older than you, and he said, Marion, you can't find two perfect pebbles, let alone four.
It was my game. I made the rules. So I had my way of working these things out. And I always found my four pebbles. I cheated at times, but it was my game, as I said, and I made the rules, and it worked for me.
Yeah. Now, your father and brother were imprisoned in the men's barracks at Bergen-Belsen, and you and your mother were in the women's barracks, but you did get to see one another.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God. How often?
Maybe once a day, because every morning we had a lineup as we were counted, on a huge field. It was called an Appellplatz. We had to stand five in a row. And it was at that time when we were men and women. Men were on one side of that big field and women on the other. And, of course, the very first thing that we all did was search for one another, to see one another. Not that we could really contact and be that close. At times, maybe, but usually not. And we were always very grateful when we would detect that the other one was alive. And how well, we don't know, but they were alive. And that standing on Appell was torture. We would have to stand there from early morning till late at night without food, without water, no matter what the weather, without protective clothing. And frostbites were frequent. And we would treat our affected toes and fingers with the warmth of our own urine. That's all we had to comfort the enormous pain. And it's just amazing how people can do this to one another.
Those moments, there were occasional moments when you could come together for an embrace. Mm-hmm. And you would pass things maybe to one another. Mm-hmm. What were those moments like?
Very special. Very special. But they were rare and not nearly often enough. But we cherished those moments.
Yeah. In the book, Four Perfect Pebbles, you describe so vividly the cold and the hunger and the brutality. This goes back to a question I asked earlier in the interview, although it was a different time, it was a different place. At this point in the story, in your story, in your family's story, what is your mom doing to, as best she could, comfort you, shelter you?
When she wasn't working and we were together, well, we shared a bunk. Accommodations. Bag and Belsen was divided into various areas, and we were in one particular section. In our section, there were triple-decker bunk beds with two people sharing each bunk, and I was so lucky to be able to share a bunk with my mother, and my brother was able to share a bunk with our father. But can you imagine two adults, two strangers, sharing a bunk under such horrendous conditions? We were given one thin blanket per bunk, a straw-filled mattress, and this bunk was our only living quarters, and that for two people. And German winters are bitter cold and very long. And so I was lucky that I was with my mom, and my mom has wonderful stories, and they were very comforting, very comforting.
Yeah. She told you about what life was like when...
Prior,
mm-hmm. back in Hoya.
Back in Germany. Hoya. And we visited Hoya only last week. We were back in Germany. And it was a week ago Tuesday that we returned from Germany. It's the 60th anniversary of our liberation. And I was invited to return. This is actually the third trip. And I spoke to students and adult groups and in German. And I spoke in Bergen-Belsen as well, three times. And tremendously well received, and it is just such a pity, such a shame that today's German youth have such guilt feelings and feel almost responsible for what their grandparents' generation have done to so many innocent people, men, women, and children. And the hugs from those German boys and girls were tremendous, and the tears. And I feel very badly for them.
What kind of feelings did you carry with you for when you made your first trip back to Germany and to Hoya?
The first trip was in 1995, the 50th anniversary of our liberation. And I returned reluctantly. I really didn't want to go back. But I was too ill at the time of my father's burial. And He has a private resting place along with about 60 others because he died 6 weeks after the liberation. Those who died early on were buried in mass graves. And this was in this little farm village of Tröbitz, where we were liberated by the Russians after having been shipped out of Bergen-Belsen, having been on a train for 2 weeks without food, without water, without medical supplies, without sanitary facilities. 2 weeks. And when the train came to a stop, those who were able and strong enough were permitted to get out and take a drink from a nearby stream or dig up roots to eat. But and my mother got water from the locomotive, from some sort of a pot. That pot was used for other purposes too. And so where were we left off? I know I leap from one thing to the other because it's all connected.
Yes. And it was 1995
that I returned right.
And you were able to see your father's grave.
Yes. And we bought pebbles that our granddaughter Arielle, who went with us last week, 2 weeks ago, to Germany. She's 17. She's the eldest of the 9 grandchildren. And when she was about 2 or 3 years old, and I took her for a walk, she used to pick up little pebbles. And she would line them up. And I, being a pebble person, I guess, I saved some of those pebbles. And when we returned in 1995, we put them on my father's grave in Tröbitz. Yeah.
There's so much heartbreak in this story, but I think one of the most moving parts of the story is how just a few weeks after your liberation, your parents contract typhus, and your father dies.
Died of them.
And so your mother is sick, something we haven't talked about. You were badly injured. You had a terrible wound on one of your legs. And so it was left to your brother, who was how old at this point?
Al was 12 years old at the time.
To bury
and
your
left,
father.
Buried my father with the help of 2 men, but basically he did most of that, and he then felt responsible for his mother and for me after my father died, and he was always scrounging around for food. The homes that we took over at the time, many of the inhabitants of this village fled. Some actually stayed to help us, and they contracted typhus, and many of them died as well. But many left, and so we took over their homes, and the kitchens were stocked with ample food. It was much too rich and good for us. We couldn't tolerate that unfamiliar nourishment, and as you had mentioned earlier, at that time, I weighed 16 kilos, or as we know it here, 35 pounds, the age of 10, and 10 and a half. And my brother just felt full responsibility and kept scrounging around for food. After a while, the food ran out in the kitchens or in the house where we stayed, and we had no money. So my brother and many others who were well enough went out to organize. He didn't steal. He organized. It sounds a lot nicer. But we had nothing. We had to eat. And no one stopped them either. I mean, it just... And then when we were ready to leave this little village in eastern Germany to return to Holland, we were on this truck and we were ready to leave. And my brother was nowhere in sight. And finally we saw him running. And he, of course, was again out collecting food in his knapsack. And as he approached the back of the truck, and as he was pulled on board, the truck lurched forward, and he lost his knapsack. And that was tremendous tragedy for him. That's all he had. It was his only possession. And there went the knapsack and all the food.
It was probably the only thing he had real control of,
that's
too.
That's another way of looking at it, for sure. Yeah.
This is mine, and I can put things in it, and I can take things out of it.
And that's all we had.
I can take things out and give them to
my
sister and my mother.
Yeah. was a terrible, terrible time that should never be repeated, and that's why I'm out there and talking about it. It's always difficult, always difficult. Have spoken to way over 300,000 students and adults in the past number of years. This month alone, we were in Memphis, Tennessee, and Birmingham, Alabama, Germany, and now we're in Illinois. Three major trips this month alone. And every month since January, somewhere else. And it's difficult, but needs to be shared, needs to be talked about.
Your schedule is just amazing. In the last couple of days here in the Champaign-Urbana area, how many engagements have you had?
Last night I spoke in quite a meaningful place called the Lincoln Challenge Academy. And it was beautifully received. Wonderful group of boys and girls, and very responsive and very receptive to this difficult subject. They too have problems, and they could see that, yes, one can overcome. So that worked very well. And then this morning I spoke at the Urbana Middle School. I'm here with you this afternoon. Mm-hmm. This evening I'll be at the
At the United Methodist Church.
United Methodist Church at 7 p.m. And at that time, there'll be a preview of the documentary, Marion's Triumph. And I will also be speaking to and with the audience. And then tomorrow evening, as you had mentioned earlier, of course, is the showing, the airing of Marion's Triumph on WILL.
Yeah. And now, how?
I will be tomorrow. Excuse me, yes? At Monticello Middle School and the Jefferson Middle School. So that's where I'll be tomorrow during the day. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us how the documentary came to be.
It was John Shua, who was a student at the University of Illinois here in Champaign, mm-hmm. Urbana, and in fact, he just received his doctorate in literature, and he had read the book, Four Perfect Pebbles. And although around that same time, Schindler's List was shown in theaters, and he was in the theater and he heard students laughing at, the entire time would have been inappropriate to make light of the subject. But that upset him enough to do something about it, to educate the youth. And he was in the midst of reading the book. He had just read the book, I'm not certain. He contacted me, my website, fourperfectpebbles.com. And we then connected, and he asked whether I would work with him to work on a documentary. He came out east and heard me speak and interviewed some of the students at that time. And one thing led to the other, and he did a very nice job, a very good job. And I'm just so grateful to him that we can get the story out in that media as well.
Yeah, it's a very moving film, as the book is a very moving story. Back to your difficulties here now. The family has come through so much, and you are seriously wounded. Mm-hmm. From your mother had managed to, she was working in the kitchen at the camp, and she managed to smuggle to the barracks some extra food, and so you were making soup, and it went horribly wrong, and you were burned.
Well, in secret, we were able to, somehow, my mother was able to cook some soup. She used an empty can as a pot. She used pieces of wood from our slats from the bunks as firewood, and she smuggled some potatoes, a little salt from the kitchen, and in secret she tried to cook some soup on our bunk. I was on the bunk with her, trying to hide and shield that setup. Soup was just about finished. It was simmering and boiling when the German guards entered our barrack for surprise inspection, and in our rush to hide that setup, the boiling soup spilled on my leg. We had been taught early on self-discipline, self-control. I knew that if I had cried out, it would have cost us our lives. And this happened in the spring of 1945. I was just 10 years old. So I hope no one is ever tested, but there's a lot that we can overcome if we have to.
How long did it take you to recover from that?
Well, because I was so undernourished and so ill along with it, it probably took a bit longer. But I was so lucky that the Russians who liberated our train treated my leg as opposed to amputating it. That's what they did immediately. Why they decided to treat the leg, I have no idea. But I was very fortunate that the wound responded to medication and it gradually healed. And as I regained my strength, I also relearned to walk. I remember them putting on a little yellow powder. I learned later on that it was sulfur, the precursor of penicillin. And every day they had me come back, and it healed. Mm-hmm. Amazing, really miraculous. And in the interim, our heads were shaved because that was the only way we could rid ourselves of head lice. We were infested with lice in Bergen-Belsen. And we learned that there was a distinct difference between head lice and closed lice and squashing them between my thumbnails. That became my primary pastime. There is just no way that I know that you've all read and you've studied and you've seen movies and documentaries, but there is no way that this can be put accurately into words or pictures. There is no way that you can describe that terrible smell, the odor, the filth, the fear, and always surrounded by death.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, you get back to Holland. Mm-hmm. And then how long are you in Holland before you finally set sail?
Okay, we were in Holland for 3 years.
Wow.
That's where I started my education at the age of 11 in a Montessori school. And we progressed there at our own pace. Dutch language was unfamiliar to us, so that was a new language to learn. We also learned Hebrew and had religious studies in that subject, and all in preparation to live in what was then still Palestine, and we know today is Israel. And our voyage was to be an illegal one. I don't know if you've heard of the Exodus, the movie, the Exodus. Anyway, it was to be an illegal transport, and my mother didn't want us to be endangered again. So she then made arrangements for us to come to the United States, and we were able to use the tickets, which we had purchased 10 years earlier. Holland America Line honored those tickets. The list was intact. And how my mother, she's a very industrious lady, how she was able to even thought about checking with it. But somebody must have advised her, and she followed through. And we arrived in Hoboken, New Jersey, April 23rd, 1948. By coincidence, exactly 3 years to the day after our liberation. And that was just last Saturday, was the 23rd.
That's right.
It was 60 years. Mm-hmm. That was 60 years that we were liberated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we arrived in the States,
and it was a Jewish relief organization that found a home for us, of all places, Peoria, Illinois. And that's where we started out all over again. At the age of 13 this time, again, a new situation, new country, again learning a new language, and adjusting to a new way of life. And because of my inability to speak English, I, at the age of 13, was placed in the fourth grade with nine-year-olds. And although my brother and I worked very long hours to help my mom pay bills, I nevertheless found time, made time to take extra courses during the year and attend summer school. And by working hard, very hard, I was able to be graduated from Peoria Central High School at age 18, 5 years later, ranking eighth in the class of 267 students.
Yeah.
So, again, with perseverance, with determination, one can do a lot.
One last story.
And then I met my husband.
I know. That's what I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you to wrap up here this afternoon. One more little story, a great one. The lid for every pot.
That's right.
You met your husband at synagogue in Peoria.
Correct. I was 16. Nathaniel was 19. He lived in New York, and he attended Bradley University. And we met on the holiday of Yom Kippur in the synagogue. And we were married 2 months after high school graduation. I was 18. He was 21. And God willing, we'll be celebrating our 52nd wedding anniversary this coming August. And I'm just very, very grateful for him and for my wonderful family. And Nathaniel is enormously supportive. And if it weren't for him, we wouldn't be able to do nearly the things as far as the book and traveling and speaking is concerned. He's very adept with the computer. So it's amazing. He's very special.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine has been Marion Blumenthal-Lazan. Tomorrow evening, WILL-TV will broadcast the documentary Marion's Triumph, Surviving History's Nightmare, the broadcast set for 8 p.m. This evening, she will speak at 7 o'clock at Champaign's First United Methodist Church at 210 West Church Street. The event is free and open to the public. If you're interested in the book, Four Perfect Pebbles, A Holocaust Story, you can find it in bookstores, you can find it on the internet, and you can find more about our guest, Marion Blumenthal-Lazan, online at fourperfectpebbles.com. Marion, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. And I have much more to share, important messages, but hopefully some of your radio audiences will join us this evening. That would be wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Todd Gleason joins us now with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thanks so much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit leading the trade lower, down 9.5 cents in the nearby May contract. November's were off 7.25. We'll take a complete look at those numbers in just a moment. From the wheat pit, futures were lower there as well today. Nearby May down 3.25, 325.5, the high for the day, the low at 316.75. And the May soft red winter wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade settlement price for the day at 319.5 was down 3.25 on the day. July futures, 335.5, the high, the low at 326.5. Settlement price for the July harvest month in the wheat, 329.25, down 4.25. And the September futures, 342.5, the high, the low at 334.5. Settlement price there at 337.25, down 3.5 cents. December contract, 352.5, the high, the low at 344.5, settled at 346.5. They were off 3.5. And the March contract, 360, the high, the low at 353. Settlement price there at $3.55, down 3.5 for the day. From the corn pit now, nearby May contract, 213.5, the high, the low at 207.5, and a settlement price at 208.25. They were down 4.75. July futures off 4.75 today as well. They had a settlement price at $2.17 a bushel, with a high at 222.25 and a low at 216.25 in the July corn. September futures, 229.25 the high, the low at 224, settled 224.5, down 4.25, and the December contract, 238.25 the high, the low at 233.25, settlement price there at 234.25, and that finished down 3.5 for the day. Now the March contract for the day, 245.25 the high, the low at 240.75, settlement price at 241.25, down 3.5 cents. And the May corn, 249 the high, the low at 46, settled on that low for the 2006 contract May, down 3.5 cents at $2.46 a bushel. From the soy complex, we'll get those in just a moment. The oats really quickly, down 2.75 with a high today of 149.25 in the May, the low at 145, settlement at 147, 2.75 lower. July oats, 152.25 the high, the low at 146.25, and they settled at 148.25. They were off 3.5. Now the soy complex, nearby May beans, 634.5 the high, the low at 625. A settlement price there in that May contract, contract at 627.25, down 9.5 cents. That's kind of an important spot. There have been a couple of times on the charts in the last year that this has been an area right at 628, actually, that there were settlement prices on the weekly charts. That happened once in July of last year and once again in August, and it's a support level that it was broken, but not by much today. So we'll talk to Paul Cooley during the closing market report in just a bit about that. In the July future, 642, the high, the low at 631. Settlement price at 633.75, down 9.75. August, 638, the high, the low at 28.5. Settlement price there at 32, down 9.25. And September beans, 31, the high, the low at 24.25. Settlement price at $6.26.5, and they were down 7.75. November, your harvest month, 630, the high, the low at 620.5, settled 23.5, down 7.25. And the January's, 630.5, the high, the low at 623, settlement price at $6.24.5, they were down 6.5 for the day. May bean meal, 199.50, the high, the low at 195.30, settlement price at $196 even, they were off 360 for the day. July bean meal, down $3.60 as well. 198.80, the high, the low at 195.10, and a settlement price at 195.50 for the July bean meal. July bean oil now had a high today of 22.72, a low at 22.52. Settlement price there at 22.67. That July contract was down 12 cents. The nearby lead option May contract had a high today of 22.60, a low at 22.37, and a settlement price from the May bean oil at 22.51, and they were down 13 cents. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
April feeder cattle, today's high 111.70, the low 111.50, the settlement 111.60, that up 2.5. May 108.85, the high 107.52.5, the low, the settlement 108 even, that down 75. August 109.55, the high, the low 107.80, the settlement 108.02.5, that down 132.5. April live cattle 93.90, the high 92 even, the low 92.45, the settlement, that down 145. June 87.35, the high 85.35, the low 85.62.5, the settlement, that down 150. May lean hog 77.45, the high 76.45, the low 77.07.5, the settlement, that up 15. June 77.35, the high 76.10, the low 76.92.5, the settlement, that up 17.5. July 77.70, the high, the low 76.65, the settlement 77.45, up 25. August 75 even, the high 74.05, the low finishing at 74.87.5, up 12.5. May bellies 82.05, the high 81.15, the low 81.95, the settlement, that up 45. The Dow up 48 points, the S&P 500 up 5.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Hillary Kane from Des Moines, Iowa writes, Dear Dr. Science, when the weatherman says the wind is NNW, does that mean it's coming from the NNW or heading towards the NNW?
Neither. It's a code weathermen used to inform other weathermen that they're about to